massive earthquakes strike off the coast of Indonesia.
Will there be economic aftershocks?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, April 11th.
Coming up, why is Europe scaring investors again?
The governor of Iowa has some beef with the people who are attacking pink slime.
And Chicago wants a longer school day.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
An 8.6 magnitude earthquake centered nearly 300 miles off of Indonesia has people around the Indian Ocean as far away as East Africa moving to higher ground. An 8.2 aftershock 3 hours later prompted a second tsunami warning, which was later lifted. So far, reports suggest a much smaller set of waves than the tsunami that killed 170,000 people back in 2004. The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar is monitoring the situation from Delhi. Hello, Sanjoy.
Hello.
Give me a sense about the feeling in the region given these bulletins about the earthquake this morning and tsunami watch.
We felt the tremors when the earthquake first hit Indonesia. Those tremors were felt along the east coast of India in cities such as Calcutta and Chennai. And that was followed by a tsunami alert across the region. A lot of people began to feel very nervous, although since then they've settled somewhat upon being told that perhaps the warnings weren't as severe as people first feared.
Is there early information about India's response to the events of today so far?
Well, almost immediately after the earthquake was felt, there was a general alert warning of the possibility of 6-meter-high waves striking areas along the east coast. Fishermen were asked to come back off the high seas. So there's a general sense of alert right across the region.
A lot of this seems to be evidence of preparations that have been made, perhaps stepped-up preparations in the wake of the disaster of some years ago.
Yes, without doubt. The 2004 tsunami caught everyone here in India completely by surprise. Now they've got these systems in place. These communities have been strengthened. The shelters have been rebuilt using materials which perhaps can withstand an earthquake or a tsunami. And at the same time, people are asked to relocate to higher ground with intermittent warnings sent out on the state media services.
Sanjoy Majumdar, BBC, Delhi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, let's get a domestic take on this now from Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's with us, as always, from New York. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well. So when there's a natural disaster like this, and this one it looks like may not be so bad, but what is an investor to do? Because obviously we just had the tsunami in Japan a year ago, the floods in Thailand, and there were some big economic effects.
Yeah, I think if you look at Fukushima and the lingering effects of that in a lot of different markets, there definitely was an adjustment. But then there are some natural disasters that really have no impact. So I think what happens is when pros hear that there was a natural disaster, the first thing they'll try to figure out is what kind of exposure they have, especially if there's any kind of commodity bent to it. So I think in this case, though, we probably won't see much of a market impact, even though it's still something that people want to keep in mind.
Well, it seems like the markets are watching Europe more closely right now. What is going on there? We had a 200-point drop yesterday in the Dow.
I thought we were done with that.
Yeah.
Europe lives on. The problems are still very much around, even though the ECB and Germany are acting more Fed-like in their approach. There are a lot more backstops and there's a lot more liquidity in the system. But we saw Italian and Spanish bond yields above 5%, and that's always vexing. So I think the market is not so much focused on it, but it is now reacting to some extent, which it hasn't for a while. And that's a new development for 2012. It's really the first time Europe has captured our attention.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
All right, well, let's go straight to Europe for more on that story with our man in Europe, Marketplace's Stephen Beard. He's with us now from London. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, what sparked these renewed fears?
Well, we could say it's your fault. The US job figures, this was a delayed reaction. European markets were closed on Monday, so yesterday was their first chance to react to these rather disappointing figures. And part of the calm here in recent weeks has been due to the belief that the US recovery would help pull the Eurozone out of trouble. That rosy scenario is now in doubt.
So you're saying it's not you, it's us.
Well, not entirely. There are renewed doubts about growth in Spain and Italy, worries about whether these governments are going to be able to raise enough tax revenue to pay their debts, raising the spectre of default. This is all genuinely worrying, says Bronwyn Curtis of HSBC.
I think we should be worried because this is continuing. We haven't solved the European problem. We had a nice period of stability, but it's not going away.
So same old fears, this time will Spain, even Italy, perhaps default? And what effect would that have on the euro?
Feel like we've been here before, Stephen, and I wonder, does the potential exist for things to really flare up like they did last fall, or are some of the systemic problems now taken care of?
I think deep down investors feel that the central banks like the Fed and the European Central Bank will ride to the rescue and turn on the money tap if a global recession threatens.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
One thing Europe does not need is another, quote, sickly market. This time it's the market for carbon credits. Prices have collapsed for the right to expel carbon dioxide into the environment. And today at a big European Union energy conference in Brussels, some policymakers were working to change that. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
If you've always wanted to cross the pond and spew a ton of carbon into the air, act now. Cost just $9. Half the price of a year ago. Of course, it's free in the States, where we don't regulate the stuff, but that's another story. Economist Robert Stavins at Harvard says Europe's carbon market is sagging because its economy is. Less buying, less selling.
The result of that is lower industrial production, hence less generation of electricity, particularly by coal-fired power plants, and hence lower emissions.
The Europeans have stayed under their emissions caps, and few companies need to buy allowances to emit more. So allowance prices have dropped. But even though Europeans have fit into those skinny jeans they designed years ago, some want to go skinnier. At EU talks today, some countries want to shrink the supply of carbon allowances so prices rise. Denny Ellerman at the European University Institute in Florence says these people want a faster energy revolution.
From that perspective, they would say the price is not high enough to yield the results that we expected with respect to energy transformation, and therefore we believe the price should be higher.
But are low prices inherently bad?
The hand-wringing in Europe is somewhat misplaced.
Robert Stavins says the market is working as intended.
When there is a recession, rather than continuing to punish private industry unnecessarily when emissions are low anyway, it loosens the constraint.
And if you wonder if low prices doom carbon markets, not in this case. The Europeans have agreed to extend their market past 2020. And more are coming in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, China, California. Marcus Ferdinand is with Point Carbon in Oslo.
Higher volumes in the market and an expectations of an even growing market gives you a certain security that this market will not be vanished from one day or the other.
Think of carbon markets as a teenager, immature, volatile, and in the end, presumably they grow up. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At Gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
Have you ever heard of lean, finely textured beef? What about pink slime? Well, they're the same thing, but the fact that more people have heard of the latter is what concerns Terry Branstad, the Republican governor of Iowa. The controversy over the widely used ammonia-treated beef has already sent one beef producer into bankruptcy. Governor Branstad joins us now from Des Moines. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I can't see you in person, but I hear you're wearing a Dude It's Beef t-shirt.
That's right. Given to me by Lieutenant Governor Sheehy from Nebraska when we had the big meeting out there with the BPI and went through and showed that it's a very good, clean, USDA-approved process that provides this lean, finely textured beef. This is a very positive campaign to get the truth out and to counter the vicious smear campaign that's been conducted.
Well, who's running this vicious smear campaign?
Well, you know, you got a celebrity chef. You've got some folks that have traditionally been against the consumption of meat. We've asked the Agriculture Committee in Congress to look into it and see if they can find out more. But there's been, a lot of this has been done kind of a shadowy thing using the social network to get that out. That's why we're going to the agriculture students who are the people, it's their future, and we want to make sure that they can counter it. And these young people, they know how to use the social media and to counter the vicious rumors and smear tactics with the truth and scientific evidence.
Governor, why shouldn't consumers be grossed out by this stuff?
Because it's not true. It's a smear campaign. It's all beef.
Do you think that big companies like McDonald's and Taco Bell have bought into the smears then?
I think they have responded to uninformed consumers that have been misled.
Now, some people are going to hear you say this and say, wait a minute, Governor Branstad is just sticking up for an industry that's important to his state and that donated $180,000 to his campaign over the last 2 years. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's what happens when you confront people with the facts. They tend to attack the people that are delivering the message. I, as governor, certainly am going to fight for jobs in my state. And I believe in agriculture, and I believe in the beef industry. We are fighting back with the truth and with scientific evidence, and the only thing they'll do is personally attack and use smear tactics. That tells you a lot about the character of the people conducting the smear campaign, doesn't it?
Governor Terry Branstad of Iowa, thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is moving ahead with controversial plans for a longer school day, 7 hours instead of 5 hours and 45 minutes. As Marketplace's Eve Tro reports, the length of the school day has its pros and cons.
Chicago children go to school about 6 hours a day, far less than kids in other major cities. Mayor Emanuel plans to stretch that by at least an hour, despite cries that the city can't afford it. Jennifer Davis heads the National Center on Time and Learning. She says lots of schools, especially charters, have figured out how to teach kids longer on less money. With technology or creative scheduling,
students can be in school longer, but staff don't necessarily have to all be there for that full time.
Some struggling school districts have extended the school day several hours, the trade-off being the school week goes down to 4 days. Dan Dominich heads the American Association of School Administrators. He says that's not great either.
You know, 8 hours or longer, there's a fatigue factor that comes into play, both on the part of children and the teachers.
Dominich says it'll take years just to return money to school coffers and extend school days back to pre-recession levels. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Postal workers are demonstrating this week against a Senate bill that they say would destroy the Postal Service. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The Senate bill would allow Postal Service executives to phase out Saturday service in 2 years and would let them eliminate doorstep delivery.
We are very concerned that Postal Service is dismantling itself.
Jim Sauber is chief of staff of the National Association of Letter Carriers. The union's biggest beef with the Senate bill, it continues to require the Postal Service to set aside money now for future retirees' health care expenses. Sauber says that should stop, and Saturday deliveries should continue because they're profitable. Rick Geddes is an economist at Cornell who studies the Postal Service. He says postal workers will have to accept major reforms, like cutting mail delivery down to 5 days a week or reducing the workforce through attrition.
In order to preserve the Postal Service, it has to change.
Geddes says without major change, the Postal Service will struggle to survive. He says mail volume is down more than 21% just since 2006. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Three-quarters of employers do background checks before hiring. Now a consumer group says too much of that background info is bunk. The National Consumer Law Center has a new report that says the job background screening industry is like, quote, the Wild West and lacks accountability. Among the problems, someone with a similar name has a rap sheet and you don't, or reports that fail to note when criminal charges are dismissed. Job seekers have the right to correct bad information, but to paraphrase the report, just try it sometime. With Rick Santorum's exit from the Republican presidential contest, political analysts say the general election is beginning in earnest. Marketplace's Bob Moon has the latest on big political action committees. You may know them as super PACs and their ongoing role in the race.
You can expect to start seeing more anti-Obama attack ads in the near future now that the Romney campaign and Republican-aligned super PACs can redirect their advertising fire. John Dunbar watches politics at the Center for Public Integrity.
Restore Our Future, which is the super PAC backing Mitt Romney, actually has more money in the bank than Mitt Romney's own campaign, or at least it did at the end of February.
Up to now, that super PAC has been doing most of its spending, roughly $40 million, on negative ads targeting his GOP rivals. But at the Political Wire website, Tegan Goddard says other super PACs were busy helping Romney's rivals extend their improbable runs.
I think what happened is the super PACs allowed the unorganized candidates like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich to continue on longer than they otherwise would have been able to.
Now, Dunbar says all those super PACs can start banding together.
They've obviously got a horse that they can back without reservation. They don't have to worry about Rick Santorum anymore. Now they can just go straight at Barack Obama.
The bulk of the spending is likely to be focused on a dozen-plus so-called battleground states considered key to a November victory. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
More than 50% of a small village in northern Spain has voted in favor of a plan to allow marijuana to be grown there. The aim is to generate money for the village to help wipe out its debt. However, it's still unclear if the idea is going to go ahead. Here for today's Midday Extra, we've got the BBC's Tom Burridge in Madrid.
Just over 800 people live in the Catalonian village of Rasquera. Only 555 of them took part in a referendum. They had to vote yes or no to the mayor's plan to cancel out the village's debt, but his plan included a proposal to allow marijuana to be grown in the village. The mayor is Bernat Pellissa.
It's an opportunity for the village. It will make the village money and it will create jobs.
A pro-cannabis organization wants to pay the village for the right to grow the drug on its land. But even though more than half of the village voted in favor of the plan, it still might not go ahead. The mayor had said he would resign if his plan did not get a yes vote of 75%. Today, though, he suggested he isn't stepping down. And then there's also the question of whether growing marijuana in the village would be legal. You can smoke it in Spain, but selling and growing marijuana are against the law. In Madrid, I'm the BBC's Tom Burridge for Marketplace.
And finally, David, in La Crescenta here in Southern California, there was a guy that yesterday was reminded just how dangerous texting while walking can be.
What happened
to him? A TV helicopter was filming. You know these TV, you used to live in L.A. You know these TV helicopters are always floating around filming something or other down on the ground. Well,
exactly.
Yesterday it was filming a 500-pound black bear that was roaming through this residential neighborhood in La Crescenta yesterday. And along came the unsuspecting walk and texter. He's just walking down the street and the TV is showing him. And then he sees the bear just in time and goes promptly running in the other direction.
Man, the hazards of staring at your little smartphone when you should, like, look up once in a while.
I don't know what app he was using. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.